Well, that's the traditional Russian army song from World War II, Katyusha, introduced here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to be discussing the Russian military and the Russian army, given its recent invasion under dictator Vladimir Putin of Ukraine on February 24th. And to discuss these issues, we want to turn to Harry Kazianis, the senior director for the Center for the National Interest, the publisher online of The National Interest, a publication for which I, among others, have published, and he's an expert on Russian military issues and a former advisor to the 2016 presidential campaign of Senator Ted Cruz. Well, Harry, thanks for joining the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great having you. You had a busy schedule today, so we've had to reschedule here for 1:30. So things are crazy, of course, going on with Russia and Ukraine. But starting out, well, just tell us, how large is the Russian military, and what type of force is it? A professional army, or is it conscripts?
Well, the Russian military is quite large. I mean, in terms of their actual professional corps, I mean, the estimates do vary. But in terms of, you know, lifers that are serving in the Russian military, you know, 20 years plus, you know, to get retirement, that type of thing. Usually it's about 300,000 to 450,000 is sort of the elite core of military forces. After that, you go into, you know, potentially 1 to 2 million of conscripts that serve anywhere from 1 year, 18 months, 2 years, that get, I wouldn't want to say low-grade training, but it's certainly nothing as good as, you know, you would see in the U.S. military or in Europe. And I think this actually goes to the heart of some of the problems that the Russians are having in terms of morale, in terms of equipment. The Russians, I don't think, really fully appreciated, you know, how well trained the Ukrainians actually were. And I think what they did was, is in terms of their, you know, their armored brigades and some of their light infantry that they sent in Ukraine in the beginning, is they didn't really send their best forces first. And I think that really had a very really big problem in terms of, you know, how fast they could go in Ukraine and try to take some of the key infrastructure over. And I think this is one of the biggest problems that they've had. They thought that they could do sort of a cheap shock and awe campaign with, I don't want to say mediocre troops, but certainly not their best troops. And I think now we're seeing some of the results in that in Ukraine and Vladimir Putin getting bogged down.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's more of a mixed force. I mean, I've seen figures like the Russian military, sort of standard military, something like 850,000 strong. And then in addition, you have like 500,000 like reserves or paramilitary units. But you're saying, so you've got a mix of like a professional corps, but then they still draft people. Do a lot of people go to the draft, or is it something that Russians try to avoid, or is it kind of like a lottery system or sort of hit and miss?
It's sort of a combination of all that. It is sort of a hit and miss. There is a lot of ways to try and get out of it, unfortunately. The challenges, of course, though, is the actual professional training. The bulk of it goes to those elite forces like Spetsnaz, their Army Corps, their Armored Corps. You know, they get the most advanced training. But if you're just either a general enlisted or draftee, if you will, the level of training that you get is very poor. Your barracks aren't very well equipped. Your machinery and things that you use is, you know, second or third rate. You know, you're going to get fed, but you're not going to be eating the best food. Morale is very, very poor at this point. And you're seeing all of this happen in real time in Ukraine. It just really boggles the mind and why they didn't send their best military forces first. Something that happened, I think, that is another issue in terms of all of this, is when the Russians actually gathered all of their forces to strike Ukraine, they cobbled them together from all the different parts of Russia. So instead of leading what would be what we call a combined forces attack, in other words, your army, your navy, your marines, your cyber, you know, your air force, you know, putting all these things together into a combined attack, what they did was is they basically cobbled all these units that have never really fought together. And that's a really hard thing to do in the 21st century. You just can't throw people together and expect them to fight cooperatively and win a war. So when you take all that, you combine all the challenges of training, all the challenges of, you know, soldiers that weren't really ready for this in terms of their overall performance, it leads to the problems that we've seen here.
Yeah, a lot of people discuss that, you know, that a lot of these conscripts, you know, they weren't even told they were making an attack. They were just told, oh, you're going on exercise, you know, until like the day before when they said, okay, now we're marching to Ukraine. And, you know, a lot of them weren't really excited to do this. And you hear reports of like people abandoning their equipment or even sabotaging their equipment and just wanting to get out of the fight. Also, you know, it's an interesting point you bring up. I've seen maps like that show like, the Russians have brought together military units from all over Russia, from like, you know, the Far East, Vladivostok, Siberia, and so forth. Again, as you say, to bring together this force. So are the Russians really straining? Is this sort of like a maximum effort for the Russians to put on this operation to bring all this stuff together?
You know, you would think this would not be a terribly difficult job for the Russians. I mean, they've been fighting in Ukraine for 8 years now. They were able to take Crimea pretty effectively within just a 2 weeks, maybe even less than that, depending on what you want to consider victory. But I think what gets lost in all of this is all the problems that we just talked about when it comes to the Russian army and combined forces. But I think the other thing, too, is that we also forget the Ukrainians themselves have been training for this fight for 8 years. The level of training the Ukrainians have gotten, not just from the United States, not just U.S. Special Forces, retired forces from the United States, U.S. Special Forces, Army, Navy, Marines that have gone into Ukraine, they've developed a lot of training programs. But what also gets lost is the British had their own training programs. The British actually did something very different where they had a train-the-trainer program. So the British would go in and teach them fine arms. They would teach them general military affairs. They would teach them how to use anti-tank weapons, how to basically fight the Russians. And then the Ukrainians would take that training and keep passing it forward. So this way, if let's say, for example, you get into a situation where you're training a reservist officer who might just go back to their city or village, you know, that training's lost. The British were smart enough to make sure that training just kept brought forward. Then when you bring together all of the military equipment that we've given the Ukrainians over the last few years, I mean, just one statistic that's crazy, we've given the Ukrainians 17,000 anti-tank missiles. The entire Russian army has 12,000 tanks. And let's be honest, the entire Russian army is not fighting in Ukraine. So again, you put all these things together, it creates a very interesting mix where the Russians were not necessarily prepared for this level of pushback. They just weren't. And as the weeks get, you know, sort of grew on, more and more weapons are going to flow to Ukraine. Now, I think the Russians, if they want, they will be able to win this war. You know, the question that comes to everybody's mind is, what will the cost be? I mean, Ukraine will basically be destroyed, but what will be left of the Russian army and military when it's over? That's, you know, deep question.
Oh, wow, that's an interesting figure. So 72,000 anti-tank missiles, anti-tank weapons, and as you say, only 12,000 tanks in the Russian military. I guess that, you know, raises questions, you know, what's the usual kill ratio for anti-tank missile versus tanks, and how many of those do you got to expend to kill tanks, or for that matter, other armored vehicles, armored fighting vehicles, infantry fighting vehicles, and, yeah, what sort of casualty ratio? But so, with all the Western help, then the Ukrainian force has really become quite effective.
Exactly. I mean, it's tough to know the actual kill ratios. You bring up a good point. As far as I know, there's never been this amount of anti-tank weapons versus, you know, relatively modern Russian tanks. I mean, the Russians have a ton of variations of different tanks, from the old T-62s going all the way to the new Armada class, which I don't think is operating in Ukraine, but you know, they certainly got their T-90s and some of the best tanks on earth, but certainly not as good as the M1 Abrams and some of the tanks that the United States and our EU partners have. But just the amount of arms that's flowing in Ukraine, I mean, Ukraine is becoming literally hell on earth. And the challenge here in all of this, and maybe we'll get to talk about this a little bit deeper, is figuring out some way to de-escalate this. You know, it's well and good to want to make sure that Vladimir Putin pays a price for all of this. He definitely should. There's no doubt about that. But I think we need to understand the collective amount of punishment and sanctions and military aid that's all flowing into Ukraine. Because at some point, Vladimir Putin is going to push back a lot more than what he is. I mean, just the amount of sanctions alone that we've hit Putin with. I mean, if you start tallying it all up, and then you tally the fact that he cannot use or deploy his central bank's reserves anymore, which are worth about $660 billion. He can't use them anymore to bail out the ruble. The amount of damage is over $1 trillion that the Russian economy faces in just 1 year alone. So it's, I think it's good that we make sure that the Russians are pushed back. I think it's smart that we try to find a diplomatic solution out of this, because we do not want to have World War III with Russia. But we have to start thinking about what the end game looks like. And I think history shows that, you know, it's easy to fight wars in modern times, but it's very difficult to figure out what the end game looks like, what's the strategy, and what, you know, to figure out what your goals are and then find a way to execute those goals without getting sucked into a quagmire for, you know, 10, 20 years like Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about the campaign so far. How's the Russian military doing in Ukraine? I mean, you say, you know, ultimately you think they could win if they really poured on the force and so forth. You know, what has this conflict shown about Russian military performance, and how are they doing in Ukraine?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Again, they should be winning this hands down. I mean, they are very good at combined arms operations. Again, you know, taking your Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, cruise missiles, drones, cyber, and putting it all together in a way where you overwhelm your opponent. You know, we talk a lot about in the U.S. military back in the 2000s, you know, Donald Rumsfeld and others used to talk about shock and awe and those type of things. The Russians should have launched a shock and awe campaign against Ukraine. And within, you know, 72 to 96 hours, rolled in and taken the most valuable parts of the country. For whatever reason, they didn't do that. You know, they sent some smaller forces in. You know, they launched a few hundred cruise and ballistic missiles. They launched some special forces operations to try to take some airports, you know, key rail facilities, you know, mass transit hubs, those type of things. But it was not the type of assault that the West and Ukraine was prepared for. We were prepared for the Russians to go all in with all 200,000 troops, with the hundreds of different types of aircraft that they had, you know, the hundreds, if not thousands or more tanks that they had prepared. We expected something more in terms of Desert Storm, in terms of the amount of missiles and cruise missiles that they would fire, ballistic missiles. For whatever reason, they held back, which doesn't make a lot of sense, to tell you the truth, because if you look at some of their more recent operations, specifically in Syria, Vladimir Putin's strategy is basically to bomb Syria back into the Stone Age, and essentially he won the war for Assad, you know, the Syrian civil war, from the air. So the only thing I could think of that makes sense is that he thought that he'd be able to win this very quickly. Maybe he got bad intelligence and they told, you know, Vladimir Putin, like, you know, look, you'd be able to win this very easily and not have to really worry about, you know, efforts in terms of to try and undermine the campaign. But now he's stuck. I mean, now the entire world is watching every bomb he drops. And because of social media, anything that he does to escalate, to try to bring this war to a close very quickly, you know, doing a lot of damage in the process, is going to be magnified in a way that we've never seen in human history before. Every war crime that he does essentially has the ability to be documented now. And what will happen is every time he does something that is appalling, there will be calls for more and more pressure to be placed upon him. And, of course, that means he's going to want to push back in his own way. And this creates a Pandora's box that we've essentially all opened collectively. And it's very difficult to see an easy way out of it.
So you say, so the total number of forces committed to Ukraine right now are in the range of about 200,000 troops. All those forces that were massed, they've been basically now committed. Is that the number we're talking about?
Yeah, for most intelligence estimates I've seen, about 95 to 98% of those forces have been pushed into Ukraine. Originally, they were holding back quite a bit. In the beginning, it was only like 20, then it moved up to about 35% over the first week. But now Russia is basically all in at this point in terms of its land forces, if you will, you know, armor, army, infantry divisions, those type of things. It held back a lot in the Air Force, but on land, they are all in, so to speak.
And against that, Ukraine is what? We've got a population in Ukraine of like 35 million people or so. I guess they're basically sort of fully mobilized, right? Do they? How many troops are they putting in the field here?
The estimates vary. I mean, it depends on what you want to count in terms of, you know, regular forces that are fully trained, that type of thing. I've seen estimates between 400,000 and 600,000 troops. But again, you know, that those are really fuzzy estimates because it depends on, you know, how much training you want to consider for that to be an actual troop. I mean, what the Ukrainians now have done is essentially mobilize anybody who can pick up a gun or a rifle to try and attack the Russians. You could debate whether if that's smart or not, but with the amount of arms that have been flown into Ukraine, whether we're talking about, you know, Javelin anti-tank weapons, NLAW anti-tank weapons from the British, Stinger missiles, all these type of things. I mean, some of this stuff is relatively easy to use. I mean, there's a lot of training videos that are on social media right now where you can literally watch Ukrainian forces training the population how to use, you know, shoulder fire rockets or RPGs and things like that. So it's tough to give you an exact number just because at this point, the whole entire Ukrainian population that can fight seems like they are willing to fight. And I think this is another reason why the Russians are getting so bogged down. I don't think they expected this, to tell you the truth.
Well, now with 200,000 troops or so in a country of 35 million, or well, even though, you know, the Russians are sort of limiting themselves to kind of more the eastern section of Ukraine and like big cities, Kiev and Kharkiv and so forth, is that enough troops for the Russians to achieve whatever objectives they would want in Ukraine? I mean, we had similar debates with the Iraq War, you know, back in 2003 and after that. You know, did the coalition forces have enough troops to really sort of, you know, stabilize Iraq? And even there, we were operating with an ally regime. We are trying to build up a new Iraqi army and so forth, and yet, you know, we are really strained to try to bring an end to violence in Iraq. So what are the Russians looking at in Ukraine?
Hell, that's the best way I can describe it. I mean, this was not a well thought out operation, and I'll be honest, going into this, my analysis was that Vladimir Putin was basically going to go in, do enough damage to the country from the air, a limited ground incursion, to basically ensure that NATO, the West, the EU would not want to touch Ukraine. That basically, you know, Putin would try to make it as much of a failed state as possible. This way he can push NATO expansion back maybe, you know, two decades or more, something like that. Very limited objectives, not trying to basically conquer the country, you know, like Adolf Hitler or something like that. I mean, you pick your historical, you know, your historical comparison, but that was essentially my analysis. But I'll be very honest, I was wrong. It seems like what Vladimir Putin thought he could do is with, you know, 100 to 200,000 troops. I don't think he even planned to commit all the troops he had there. Of course, he'd want to keep some forces in reserve. His goal seems to be to want to capture at least half the country, you know, basically from Kiev going west to the Russian border to Belarus, and then basically connecting, you know, Odessa, Crimea, Mariupol, back into the Donbass. So essentially conquering at least half the country, maybe a little bit more. Even conquering half the country with just 200,000 troops, I don't see how he thinks he could do that. I mean, the amount of resistance that he is going to face with such a small force relative to what he's trying to capture seems like a fool's errand. And then when you look at how ineffective the Russians have been, I mean, they could do it, but the question now is with the Russian economy in a tailspin and possibly headed to collapse within the next 3 to 6 months, how does he think he's going to be able to afford that? I don't have a really good answer for you, especially once oil production in the United States, OPEC, maybe Venezuela and Iran now, that seems like that's on the table. Those producers will come back online, you know, with oil being anywhere between $110 to $130 a barrel, depending on when you look at it. Oil prices will go back down, and that will mean Vladimir Putin will not have the resources to maintain all of this. What happens to his army? What happens to his regime? So these are much bigger questions that sort of tack on to your question, but they're all part of the mix, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I mean, people are, you know, making comparisons, of course, to, like, you know, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan fighting that Soviet occupation for 10 years. And, you know, similarly, like, even in eastern Ukraine, with such a level of mobilization and intensity of opposition to this Russian invasion, you know, just any column going down a road, a supply column or whatever, you know, soldiers going out into the countryside, you know, they could be under attack. And so, you know, fighting that way just constantly every day, that, you know, that's going to raise a lot of casualties.
Exactly. And it's going to be costly. Like I said, I mean, I've seen different estimates, and these vary all over the place, but this is all pre-invasion. But I've seen estimates from anywhere from $2 to $20 billion a year that it would be in terms of cost to keep his soldiers in the field, supplied, fed, and fight it. The Russians were not ready for this. I mean, they don't even have the munitions industry set up to keep pumping out just the dumb bombs. We're not even talking about precision-guided munitions. We're talking about just regular old bombs that would be dropped from Soviet-style bombers like the Tu-22M3, the old Tu-95, the Tu-160. I mean, essentially, what's the old Soviet Air Force that the Russians have reconstituted to go back into Ukraine and fight? I mean, they're not built for this type of war. They're built for short, sharp wars, as the phrase is used, to fight, you know, big combined arms forces wars and fight them quickly and fight them effectively, or just fight from the air like they did from Syria. So they were not prepared for this. They were not ready for, you know, what amounts to Afghanistan 2.0 for them. You know, they don't have the economy, the infrastructure, anything to do this. So my hope is that Putin will realize this and try to look for some sort of way out. He made some comments today that he said that his diplomats seem to have made some sort of progress, and I'm greatly paraphrasing there. So maybe that's a signal of the West that he's looking for a compromise. I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah, oh, that's interesting. So, you know, you had sort of similar problems like during the 2011 NATO-Libyan air campaign. You know, certain countries like, I guess, Britain and so forth were worrying that they were running out of munitions to use in Libya. Of course, the West is much more dependent on, you know, precision-guided munitions, PGMs, you know, smart bombs. You're saying that there's a similar problem with Russia, that they're really not designed for any sort of long-term campaign, or they don't have that economic capacity they've built up. You have this phrase that you fight in modern wars, come as you are wars, that you simply have the stocks on hand of munitions and weapons, and you got to fight with that, and you don't really have any quick resupply.
Exactly. I mean, I think a lot of it is just a lot of analysts, maybe even myself in some respects, but just the general public. You know, we think of the big great wars of the past. You know, we think about World War II in some respects, and we think that we can just crank out, you know, modern weapons like sausages. Those days are over. I mean, the weapons that we use, even sort of dumb, unsophisticated Russian smart bombs, I mean, let's face it, those are created in factories that still need technology, computers, sophisticated machinery tools to even make those bombs. And the West has sanctioned a lot of that, you know, the technology, computer chips, microchips that would go into the factories that would be needed to make this stuff in the first place. So these are the problems that Putin is going to have the longer this war drags on. And when you combine all that, again, with the amount of arms that are going into Ukraine, he's got a major problem in his hands. Maybe he's looking for, you know, some outs to try and solve that. But again, I don't think he thought this through, or maybe he was given bad intelligence. But either way, he's stuck with it now.
Well, I guess that brings up interesting historical questions. Looking at the Russian military since the end of the Cold War, how has it changed from the Soviet military, and how has Vladimir Putin influenced the Russian military?
That's a really great question. Right after the end of the Soviet Union, when everything collapsed, there was a period of about, God, I want to say almost 10 to 12 years, where essentially the Russian military was just left to rot and die. You had some countries that actually took advantage of this, specifically China, went there and basically bought all of the best Soviet equipment that we could. And then now you actually see a lot of that infused in the Chinese military. In fact, the Chinese military is built off the best Soviet equipment. One quick example, their very first aircraft carrier is actually a Soviet aircraft carrier that they claimed that they were going to buy as a casino. Instead, they refurbished it and made it into a new Chinese aircraft carrier. But the Russians really, since that point in the beginning of the 2000s, really started to reconstitute their military. It is still built on the foundations of a lot of the old Soviet equipment. So you don't see a lot of brand new platforms. A lot of the tanks, for example, the old T-72s, T-62s, T-80s, T-90s. I'm not trying to be too geeky on you, but basically it is built on those foundations. They have upgraded a lot of it. They have added a lot of new equipment. For example, they have put different technology on their tanks to ensure that They're a little bit less susceptible to anti-tank weapons. They have tried to modernize their only sole aircraft carrier. That hasn't exactly gone over very well. But they have tried to build new attack submarines. They've tried to build new ballistic missile submarines. They've tried to modernize when they can. Going into, say, the 2010s, if you will, they spent a lot more money in military modernization. They were able to do that because of high oil prices. And obviously, when oil hit, you know, $148 a barrel back in 2008, that gave them at least temporarily a good amount of money to invest into their military. And you can see a lot of the results. I mean, if you see what the Russians were able to do in 2014 in Crimea, they were very effective at using special forces operations to go in, take parts of the country, take parts of the infrastructure very rapidly, and use influence operations to trick, you know, not a majority of the population, but a good chunk of the population, that it was their interest to sort of sign on with Mother Russia. And then you look at the brutality of their air campaign in Syria. It was devastating, and it was something the world really hasn't come to grips with. It didn't really get in the pages of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, if you will, but the Russians were absolutely brutal and cruel. They used the small amount of precision-guided weapons that they had in Syria. They tested those out. They used Syria essentially as a platform to test as much of their new weaponry that they built as they could. A lot of it was using, you know, Soviet-era bombers, fighter bombers, things you see in Ukraine right now, like the Su-34, Tu-22 M3-3, which is a Soviet-era fighter bomber that's pretty decent, that can do a good job at hitting ground targets. And they tested out a lot of the upgrades that they had made, and they were devastating. Like I said before, they were able to essentially turn the war that Assad was losing into a victory for him. I mean, the country was basically turned to ash, but the Russians were able to also sort of fine-tune a lot of their tactics on how they would fight a modern war. And one of the things they're doing in Ukraine, and they learned this in Syria, is to bomb the civilian infrastructure and bomb anything that involves basically innocent people that are in the most dire straits. This is why the Russians are bombing hospitals. Why in Syria they actually would bomb hospitals that specialize in children's care, cancer centers, water treatment facilities, facilities that actually dealt with AIDS and HIV. They would bomb the people that were actually in the most need. And they did it very deliberately to get the population to basically give up and turn on their own government. And it is essentially taking genocide and weaponizing it. And that's pretty scary in and of itself.
Well, okay, so you're saying they really are sort of systematically committing war crimes in Ukraine. What do you think might be the effect of that, or what could be the possible fallout for that? You say, I mean, in Syria, maybe, you know, there's sort of like the Sarah Palin attitude, you know, let Allah sort it out. I mean, you know, there's just all these bad actors there. We don't want to get involved. But here, of course, you know, the world is really paying attention and is taking an interest. What do you think might happen there?
You know, I have to be honest, I'm very concerned. I'm more concerned about this national security crisis than any I've ever been in my entire career. Like I said, I think it is a good thing to make sure that we call out any war crime, any sort of, you know, horrible act that Vladimir Putin creates. We need to bring those to light. The people that are involved should be brought in front of The Hague and prosecuted. That probably never happened, but I think it's something that we have to do to ensure that, you know, that we're following international law, and we should do everything we can to try and get Vladimir Putin to stop this war, to bring his forces back into Russia and make him pay as heavy a price as we can. But I think at the flip side of this, we do have to start thinking about what the consequences of those policies are. The Russians, I've done a lot of track two work with a lot of different Russian scholars and diplomats, retired diplomats. They've all been consistent in what they've told me. If Russia, and specifically Vladimir Putin, feel that his reign is threatened, if the Russian homeland itself is threatened, and perhaps even their economy, society, the way of life, they will use weapons of mass destruction. Specifically, they would use tactical nuclear weapons if they felt threatened. That you can actually find the documents online, their sort of new strategies, that what is usually referred to as escalate to de-escalate. They've changed that a little bit in the last few years, but that's generally the premise of the strategy. A lot of it is because they know that they're not able to beat NATO in a conventional war. And they also know they're not really able to beat the West if there was to be an influence war in terms of, you know, if Russia's in a conflict like it is in Ukraine, they would not be able to beat the, you know, the amount of social media posts and angry tweets and Instagram messages about what Russia's doing. They have no way to counter that narrative. So the strategy that they've essentially come up with is we're going to bring this to the most destructive point we can as a way to deter you, as a way to get you to back down. And I hate to say it, we are rapidly getting to the point where I think the Russians would at least start to consider those options. And you see it sort of permeating out a little bit. I mean, just a few weeks ago, it was 2 weeks ago this Saturday, Vladimir Putin went to his generals and said, you know, I'm putting Russian forces, nuclear forces on a special alert. It was never really clear what that meant, but I think it's clear if you really dig down and know what Russia's strategic goals are and sort of what some of their red lines are. You know, we also see the Biden administration talking about the Russians might be thinking about using chemical or biological weapons. It's because they know the amount of sanctions that are hitting them and will hit them in the next few months are the most punishing sanctions that have ever been put on any country ever. So, again, we have to start thinking about what are our end goals and what are America's interests in all of this and, you know, what we hope to see for Ukraine in the future as well. I think we need to really start thinking about these things right now. We need to start thinking about what the end state of this is going to look like. I think if we're lucky, to be honest with you, the end state is an imperfect one. I think you're going to see Russian forces probably de facto controlling some parts of Ukraine. I know a lot of people aren't going to want to stomach that, but that's just reality. I think you're going to see the Ukrainian economy basically destroyed, but Ukraine will, what's left of Ukraine, will come a lot closer to NATO and the EU. They're never going to be able to join those institutions, but de facto, they'll essentially be part of the West. There's no way they're going to want to orientate themselves to Russia at this point. And you'll see a Russia that's marginalized and decline and essentially dependent on China for everything. Essentially, think of Russia now as a giant North Korea that is going to sell China everything it possibly can as a lifeline. So the ramifications of this war are off the charts. And the goal is that scenario I laid out to you is a really horrible one. It's a terrible one, but it might be the best one that we have. And a lot of people aren't going to like that. You know, a lot of our neoconservative friends and others are going to want to see Vladimir Putin deposed. That's just not possible without a nuclear weapon.
Hello?
Hi there.
Oh, yeah, you skipped out of it. Yeah, okay, well, a lot of issues there. Well, how does the Russian military compare to NATO? You talk about Russia being scared of NATO. What are sort of the comparisons there between NATO forces in the West, you know, Germany, United States, Britain and such, and Russian forces?
Great question. I've done a lot of wargaming on this over the last 5 or 6 years. And in a conventional straight-up matchup, you know, one-on-one, so to speak, a lot of it is situational. A lot of it is based on, you know, how long you think that war is going to go and geography. Give you a quick example. If you're talking about a Baltics fight, the Russians in most scenarios will be able to take the Baltics over within 72 to 96 hours. Different think tanks like RAND and others have done these scenarios and done a great job sort of laying them out. But you have to assume that NATO would not allow that to sort of, you know, to be the new status quo. And eventually over time, weeks, months, NATO forces build up in Europe. You know, a lot of forces come over from the United States and all over the world into the European theater, and we eventually do win that war. The problem is, though, in every scenario I've ever fought, the Russians always make up for some of their deficiencies in conventional arms by using tactical nuclear weapons. Give you one quick scenario. We were doing a Baltic simulation a few years ago, and we were actually holding the Russians back pretty well using a lot of Tomahawk cruise missiles, using a lot of different precision-guided munitions, and we decimated the Russians' air defenses very, very quickly. In the scenario, we assumed that we got tipped off that we were coming, and we were able to act very, very quickly to sort of blunt that offensive. First thing the Russians did in that scenario, they went right to tactical nuclear weapons. They started eliminating a lot of British infantry that was in Poland, that was there for a stage operation that we had in this exercise, and literally the scenario went nuclear within a few minutes, and within literally a few minutes, we figured out that about 100 million people died. So the Russians, in a conventional sense, if they had no nuclear weapons, would never be able to beat NATO. It's over. It's just a matter of how fast NATO forces are going to go to Moscow to depose Putin. Fortunately, the Russians are not going to fight fair. They will use nuclear weapons. They have a lot of tactical nuclear weapons. They literally, and their training exercises, they train assuming they are going to use tactical nuclear weapons if they're going to fight NATO. And this is what it makes it all very scary, because, again, Russia will not aim for a fair fight. They will go all in very quickly.
Well, that raises an interesting point. With this invasion of Ukraine, does this portend any sort of future threats of Russia to other European countries like the Baltics and NATO, and how might NATO prepare for that?
You know, another good question. If we were talking maybe 6 months ago, I would have said to you there's no way that they would attack NATO. There's no reason for them to do that. You know, a lot of their fears about NATO expansion are a little overblown, to be honest. You know, NATO isn't looking to certainly invade Russia or conquer Russia or something like that. That's ludicrous. But what does history tell us? I mean, we have to go back and look at the record. I mean, look at the things that Vladimir Putin has done during his reign. I mean, he saw, potentially, Chechnya separating from Russia. So he decided to basically flatten Grozny to the ground. He destroyed that city. You know, anywhere from 12 to 25,000 people were killed in what is siege warfare. You know, fast forward a few years later to his attack on Georgia. He basically baited the Georgian military to attack after the Russians pushed, basically pushed first. He basically turned Georgia into a rump state. Fast forward again to 2014, where the Russians basically leveraged the Maidan Revolution to take over, some very valuable real estate in Crimea. And what a lot of people forget is the Russians basically stole the Ukrainian Navy in the process. So we can look at all these. There's a lot of even smaller things that the Russians have done over the years, whether it's cyber attacks on Estonia, cyber attacks on the United States, other countries. I mean, let's face it. The Russians are not always what I would call rational actors. They basically hang on the fringe of rationality. So, after the Ukraine crisis is over, or even during this crisis, will the Russians expand their attacks to something else that involves NATO? I suspect in the next few weeks you will see the Russians do something that is escalatory once those sanctions start to bite, once the costs really start getting driven up for Putin. Once Russians run out of money, they can't go to ATMs. I mean, they already can't use Visa and MasterCard and are going to have to basically depend on Chinese credit card transaction systems. So the costs are coming to Vladimir Putin very, very, very quickly. I think what he's going to end up doing, my gut tells me, is he's going to launch a cyber attack on the West, maybe not on the United States or EU proper, but he may launch one on, say, Poland or, the Baltic countries or something like that. And do it in a way where attribution of that cyber attack is not easy to surmise. Whether it's using, Russian cyber forces stationed in other countries that are basically been waiting to strike, that have been sitting there for a long time, or leveraging proxy servers in different ways where it's very hard to get that attribution. And then the West has a choice. Do we invoke Article 5 in fight back? It's tough choices, because what ends up happening from there is you start going up that escalation ladder, and it starts looking like the Cuban Missile Crisis, although in a very different 2022 sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, I've read reports from various think tanks. I'm trying to remember. I think it was the Center for Budget Priorities, their report on the Baltics a couple of years ago, maybe about 4 years ago, talking about how they were advocating, you need to, beef up forces in the Baltics to really deter any sort of Russian advance, because once you get a Russian advance in there, Putin might want to make a quick strike, fait accompli, take it over, and then sort of dare NATO and say, okay, what are you going to do now, and to thereby sort of try to crack the alliance, because once they get in, then of course you're faced with, you've got to sort of drive them out. So as maybe you've talked about, that would involve say an air campaign where you try to, just really sort of like in Kosovo or in the first Gulf War, just really destroy the concentrated Russian formations. But then you say, the Russians might go nuclear after that and strike back at, say, air bases and so forth. So I guess that's an interesting question of what do you do in the Baltics?
Yeah, the Baltics are the most difficult challenge in terms of trying to defend them. I mean, they're in a very, very difficult spot in the Black Sea, very, very difficult to get naval forces in there, difficult to get things like aircraft carriers and, and submarines into that area. Submarines are difficult because the water's shallow, so you can't really hide them in terms of their stealth capabilities. Aircraft carrier is nearly impossible because the Russian anti-active area denial capabilities, in other words, the amount of missiles that they could put on target on those aircraft carriers basically makes sure they're them essentially sitting ducks. So it would take a long time to get the forces across from the U.S. Into that region to try and deter the Russians or to stop them. The Baltics are basically the nightmare scenario. So that's the one that NATO was really trained up for the last 10 years, you know, preparing and thinking that the Russians might want to make a move there. I still doubt that they would want to do that. But again, I'm very surprised that the Russians have already gone this far. So at this point, it really is a very unpredictable situation where it's hard to get into Vladimir Putin's head. The only saving grace in all of this is that I'm hoping that we have sort of dialed up the pressure enough where he looks for sort of a face-saving way out of this predicament. You're getting a little bit of indications of that today, maybe, but again, we'll have to see.
Well, thinking of the Baltics again, that brings up other issues. You know, there's been growing consideration in Sweden and Finland that they might join NATO. Should they join NATO? Would that help defend the Baltics? What other aspects would be to consider there?
Well, I think Sweden and Finland are interesting. I mean, for the longest time, their populations have not necessarily been anti-NATO, but not necessarily wanting to throw all in. Obviously, because of the Article 5 declarations and in terms of, you know, having to have collective defense and, you know, those countries necessarily having to go to war against Russia or some other party someday where it might not be in their national interest to do that. Finland specifically has been, you know, famously neutral when it comes to Russia. It was very subservient to the Soviet Union during the Cold War days. Sweden has been a very, very neutral country, although their military is very underrated. They have some of the best military equipment on Earth in terms of anti-tank weapons, fighter jets. They have one fighter jet called the JAS 39 Gripen, which is one of the best fourth-generation fighter jets on the planet. It is outstanding. So, you know, it would be interesting to see if they want to join NATO. I think if this war goes on and stretches from weeks to months, I think there's going to be a very strong pull and determination to do it. And it's something that, again, it just shows the folly of Vladimir Putin's, you know, logic in all of this, that he was not prepared for, you know, the second and third tier ramifications that were going to come. I never ever thought I'd see a day where those two countries would want to join NATO, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, there have been recent opinion polls that in both countries, like over 50% now say they want to join NATO, which, you know, a big spike. And, you know, over the years since the end of the Cold War, there's been sort of growing movement in both countries. I mean, Finland in particular, you know, they're apparently, I guess, they're in the process of buying the F-35 fighter. I mean, and before that, they bought the F-A-18. So, you know, in terms of their equipment, they've made a real switch to Western technology, and they bought the Leopard tanks from Germany and so forth. So they've shifted away from all the old Soviet equipment they used to buy in order to placate the Soviet bloc during the Cold War, and now they've got so, you know, a lot of interesting developments there. Well, looking in the other direction, you talk about with these sanctions on Russia and so forth that Russia might very well have to turn to China for, you know, weapons development, economic relief using credit cards or whatever. What would that entail for Russia for it to become kind of, as you sort of indicate, maybe like an even larger, bigger North Korea for China?
Well, for Russia, I hate to say it, that might end up being the best of scenarios for them, and that just shows you what a bad situation they're in. In some respects, this happened a little bit in the early 1990s. Give you a quick example. The old Soviet industrial base was basically destroyed when the Cold War was over. You know, Russian military factories were on their backs, and China came in with what, you know, with deals to try and basically keep them alive. There's one great example where the Chinese bought something called the Su-27 Flanker, which was at the time a great fourth-generation fighter. It still is. Long story short, what the Chinese basically did is they made a very small order of about 24 aircraft. They were happy with those. A few years later, they came back, and that deal got expanded where they would get 100 of those jets from the Russians, and then another 100 more would actually be built in China, where the Russians would help them set up their own manufacturing. And there would be some natural technology transfer. That was always assumed. And it was a deal that was worth a few billion dollars. The Russians made similar deals in other things like submarines. the S-300 air defense system, which is very, very, you know, popular and well thought of. But what ended up happening was the Chinese cheated in almost every single one of these deals. We don't have the exact details on every single one of these situations, but we do have a lot of detail on the Su-27. What ended up happening was the Chinese canceled the deal about a quarter of the way through, saying that they didn't need the jets anymore. There's different allegations saying that, you know, the Russians or the Chinese side cheated on different aspects of the deal. But it does seem like the Chinese were the ones who cheated, because a few years later, back in about, I think it was 2011, when the Chinese actually wheeled out a fighter called the J-11, which is almost an exact copy of the Su-27, and they actually were so bold to try and sell it on the arms market and compete with the Russians for the exact same arms sales. So I think the same thing is going to happen, except this time the Russians are basically going to have to allow it to happen. I think the Chinese are going to go in knowing that nobody's going to want to buy Russian military arms anymore, because let's face it, I mean, any country that wants to buy Russian military equipment is going to be considered, you know, an agent of Vladimir Putin, or, you know, helping fund the Russian war machine, which, you know, the second part's at least true. That's for certain. And you're going to see the Russians having to go hat in hand, not only for military sales, but also oil, natural gas, timber, lumber, farm products, finished goods. The Russians are basically going to have to open the country to the Chinese, because they're not really going to have anybody else who will be able to take the moral onslaught, if you will, to do it. You know, I don't think the West has the stones, if you will, to want to take the Chinese on. I mean, the United States and China have something like a $700 billion bilateral trade relationship. So there's really no way the United States is going to start sanctioning Chinese companies for essentially getting in on the fire sale of Russia. There's, you know, we're not going to want to take the economic damage. So I think for Putin, you know, looking at the various options in front of him, if this war were to continue on, when the sanctions really start to hit him, China is his lifeline. And that's kind of sad for a country that has a proud history, you know, in good days, if you will, when it comes to Russia.
Are there any dangers for such a relationship for Russia? I mean, well, you know, I guess, you know, in the past, sometimes people talk about, like, maybe China might want to ultimately, say, like, take territory in the Far East, you know, Siberia from Russia, where you have, like, a lot of illegal Chinese immigration into or such. Or how would the Russians feel about being so dependent on China like that? What sort of effects would you have there?
Oh, they hate it. I mean, I can tell you back to conversations we had that date from 2012 that the Russians were never happy about being essentially a junior partner of China. But they knew that their own national interests diverged so much from the United States and Europe, or at least they perceived them to be, that they looked at China as the only real natural ally that they had. I think they look at the risks now in terms of dealing with the Chinese as awful. I mean, I don't think that they want to have to be in a situation where they have to basically sell the Chinese all of their best military hardware on the cheap to keep those industries going. And it's dangerous for the United States too, obviously. I mean, you know, we were talking a little bit about how the Russians have modernized their military. It's really in the last 2 to 3 years that the Russians have had some major breakthroughs in their military technology. I mean, we've all seen the headlines on Russian hypersonic weapons. We've seen some of the things they've developed, like the Poseidon. They have a lot of different hypersonic cruise missiles that the Chinese would love to get their hands on. The Russians are working on a new stealth bomber program. Not exactly sure how far along they've gotten, but they're working on it. They've developed not one, but two different stealth fighter projects. One, the Su-57, has come a long way. They actually have 10 of them, so I'm sure the Chinese would love to get their hands and look at those. The Russians are working on a cheaper stealth fighter called the Su-75. It's called the Checkmate. I'm sure that's another one the Chinese would love to get their hands on, at least in terms of the blueprints or what the Russians are thinking. And the list goes on and on. Submarines, aircraft carrier technology, these are all things that the Chinese would love to get their hands on and that they could probably buy perhaps in the months to years to come on the cheap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thinking of fighter aircraft, do you think it would be a good idea, this proposal that came up, to transfer, you know, MiG-29s from NATO countries like Poland that had them, these legacy aircraft from the Soviet bloc, to Ukraine so the Ukrainian Air Force could use them?
I'm so glad you asked this question because there's so much misinformation on this. So here's the problem with that. It sounds really good. Don't get me wrong. You know, it would definitely be helpful for the Ukrainians to have more air power in the sky. They have not deployed it in large sort of fieldable missions just yet, but they're going to need it. That's very clear. But here's the thing. Just because Ukrainian fighter pilots, air and ground crews, maintenance crews have familiarity with Ukrainian MiG-29s, that does not necessarily mean that carries over to Polish MiG-29s. Something that isn't well known is a lot of these older MiG fighters, even as one as good as the MiG-29, the MiG-29 is actually a pretty decent fighter. A lot of these aircraft over the years have been completely ripped apart and modernized. Specifically, the Polish version of the MiG-29 has very different avionics, very different heads-up screens, different computer systems, and we can't forget the language barrier. On this MiG-29 are going to be in Polish. And that's not all easy to convert over. I mean, you just can't just hand these fighter jets over to Ukraine and say, good luck, go into combat with a jet that, in all intents and purposes, just shares the same name. They could be very well a very different fighter aircraft. So not only do you have to be able to make all of those transitions or rip all the equipment out and put something in similar, then you've got to get the pilot trained on whatever's left in wartime. In the best of conditions, that would take months. I don't know necessarily how the Ukrainians would be able to do that now. It sounds great. Give them the fighters. It sounds like the very noble and patriotic thing to do. But I have to tell you, I don't think it would really work out in a scenario such as this. I mean, if we weren't in wartime and we were thinking about transferring those fighters, sure, we could do it within 6 months to a year, and they would have very viable, very strong fourth-generation MiG-29. Right now, it's a pretty dumb idea.
Well, looking at Ukraine and toll in the future, you discussed this. What could be a possible outcome for Ukraine, or looking at solutions, giving Putin an off-ramp and so forth and all? Could you offer like a moratorium on Ukraine joining NATO and the EU in the future? Like, I guess even if Ukraine were to try to do it, it's a very long-term project. I mean, something that wouldn't happen for a decade at least, or maybe two decades or something. But in working in the meantime on just simply strengthening Ukraine so it's a stronger society, civil society, its economy is built up, its defense is once again built up, and then with this fight that they put up with the Russians, they can sort of show the Russians, look, we can stand up to you. You can't just come in and easily conquer us. So you're going to have to make some sort of compromise with us.
There's a lot of things that we can do that will really strengthen Ukraine that doesn't necessarily mean Ukraine joins NATO. I think the Russians have shown that they are completely terrified of NATO, and they are completely obsessed with the idea of Ukraine joining NATO. The reasons, we don't have enough time to get into them all, but just very quickly, they are very nervous about Ukraine's demographics, natural resources, agricultural output, the growing strength of their military, thanks to the United States and EU and the Baltic countries. They do not want a country like that on their borders. And then as you see that their democracy, even with all the problems that it has, was starting to flourish and getting better in terms of their civil society, civil law, those type of things. The Russians didn't want that type of country on their borders, and I think that goes to speak to a lot of the reasons why they've done what they've done. But that doesn't – even if we rule out NATO right now, that doesn't necessarily mean there isn't a ton of things that we can do to strengthen that country. Give you a quick example. The United States, when this war is over, can give the Ukrainians a ton of different types of military equipment that we do not use anymore that we can train them to use. Two examples. We have thousands of older M1 Abrams tanks that would be perfect for the Ukrainians that we could do some slight upgrades to. Would not take very long, a few months, maybe a year at most, as long as they're not in wartime. And we could get those tanks to the Ukrainians for free and ensure that they have a good fighting chance in terms of taking on Russian armor someday if they ever had to, and not be just so dependent on anti-tank missiles. They would be able to fight in the field in a little bit more of a fair scenario. We could also give them a lot of A-10 Warthogs that we have just basically rotting in fields in different parts of the country. You know, older planes, about 50, 51 years old, but it does have the capability to destroy a lot of these Russian tank columns that we see there, or we did see sitting outside of Kiev. You know, they're not very good in terms of taking on, you know, modern air defense systems, but it doesn't seem like the Russians are very good at operating them anyway. So there's a ton of things that we can do that do not necessarily mean that Ukraine joins NATO. I mean, you know, we can do all those things, and, you know, we can integrate the Ukrainians as much into NATO command as possible and not necessarily give them a formal invitation either. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we could do right up to the point of NATO membership and not call it NATO membership. And if that's what we have to do to ensure that Ukraine is a, you know, is a vibrant, prosperous country and not start a war with Russia, that doesn't seem like a bad thing to do.
Yeah, and so are you saying that is Russia really worried? I guess maybe they'd have similar fears for the Baltics, but maybe it's even larger with Ukraine that, you know, if you have a successful society establishing itself in Ukraine, a Western society, that has been, as people have spoken in the past, a kind of a magnet effect on Russia. You know, Russians will look at that and say, hey, how come we can't do that? You know, why do we have to live with some guy like Vladimir Putin? Or for that matter, Belarus as well to the north, this kind of Russian satellite might also start to develop similar ideas.
You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly it. You know, the Baltics, they were upset and angry about, but Ukraine's obviously a very, very different situation because of its size, basically the size of Texas, state population, about 44 million people altogether, depending on, you know, what stat you're looking at. Very, very technologically savvy society. You know, it is the poorest country in Europe, but it also has the biggest potential in Europe, too, to really become an economic heavyweight in Europe overall. So that, you know, the potential is all there, and it's that potential that drives Vladimir Putin essentially crazy.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking of Vladimir Putin, is the Russian military, and for that matter, the wider Russian country, really loyal to him? If you talk about, you know, you mentioned the idea of, say, regime change and so forth. You know, what possibilities are for them for, I don't know, a palace coup or something for him to fall, and who might come and replace them? Or is it, again, as you say, a sort of a larger North Korea that, you know, everyone's just so brainwashed and nuts and so forth that with or without Putin, you know, things are just going to pretty much stay the same in Russia?
Well, I mean, Alexei Navalny is always the one who's sort of, you know, wheeled out as the person who could lead a Russian democracy. But, I mean, obviously he's in jail. He has his own problems right now, so that could be obviously very difficult. You know, the thing is there's no, you know, general in the waiting or strongman who can sort of take Russia over and, you know, lead some sort of palace coup. There's nobody out there that is, you know, within the Russian government that's sort of the perfect person to sort of take the country over. I also think, too, that Vladimir Putin would never allow that to happen. I mean, I think, you know, obviously he has his finger on the nuclear button. And he'd be willing to use it depending on the scenario. So I don't think, you know, that's a viable option either. I mean, there is other sort of more wackier ways things could change. I mean, we do have a Russian presidential election in 2024. Doesn't really seem like there's any viable Democratic candidate that Putin would, number one, ever allow to run, and number two, ever be able to defeat Putin. But I think this is one of those things that, you know, if the war were continue on for weeks, months, or years, I don't really see Vladimir Putin's Russia, the way it is sort of encapsulated now, surviving the way it is. It's not possible. You know, the Russian people have tasted a little bit of what the West has to offer. Maybe they don't, you know, fit in perfectly with every Western standard that we look at in terms of democracy or economics and things of that nature, but I do think that they do not want to live in an autocracy like China either. So I think for the Russian people, a time of choosing, if you will, is coming. And, you know, Vladimir Putin basically pushed that, you know, fast-forwarded that maybe by about 15 years, and I don't think the Russian people are going to like what comes to them in the next 6 months, because one of the things about sanctions that we all forget about is, you know, we're trying to hurt the regime and we're trying to hurt the people around Vladimir Putin. But just as always the case, it's the average Russian that's going to suffer the most. And that's what I think Putin is worried about.
All right. Well, for our listeners out there, we've been discussing Russia's military in Ukraine here for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod. We've been talking with the Center for the National Interest Senior Director, Harry Kazianis. Well, Harry, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you, my friend.
Enjoy it. All right, for our listeners out there, tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.